This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices, united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
It's been a long time, but it's time to actually talk some football, some college football, because I'm feeling more confident by the day that we're definitely going to have some type of college football season. And joining me on another edition of the Dustin McComas Show on the Yak.com, I am, of course, Dustin McComas of OrangeBloods.com, as you can hear in the title name, is Brody Miller of The Athletic. He covers LSU for The Athletic. He covers everything LSU, which has been a wild ride to be on that beat over the last 18 months or so, as LSU obviously won the national championship last season. Joe Burrow won the Heisman. Joe Burrow became the number one overall pick, and so on and so forth. So I thought it was a good time to get Brody back on. I was joking with him over direct message that, hey, you had the second highest rated podcast that I've done of these. Like, Texas fans, you know, that was before Texas played LSU, so I'm not quite sure what they think of you now. But obviously they liked what you were saying, and people just – that LSU-Texas game, it's obviously very unrealistic to ever make that a yearly thing, I think. But it seems like both fan bases would love that. At least they've played in basketball recently. They played in baseball much. They played in football last year, and they're going to play in football again. So first off, Brody, how are you handling the global pandemic as we all are trying to get used to life without sports, but maybe sports are coming back? But you mentioned as you were coming on, Tropical Storm Cristobal, we were joking about the hurricane season. That's going to be going on. So before we get into anything else, what's life been like for you over these last 3-4 months or so?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, like, I guess I shouldn't say like everybody else, but like a lot of people where it's just trying to stay busy. A lot of, you know, I moved into a new house with a girlfriend literally the week this all started. So that's been the ultimate test of a relationship. The first 3 months dating is full time together. Mastered my cocktail game. I guess those have been the main things, and just hoping for a return of sports, man.
Man, that's moved into a house right when the pandemic hit. That's I'll say, if y'all survive this, you will survive anything in life. And there's no doubt in my mind.
That's been the motto, and so far so good. So far we're still together.
Well, good to hear everything is going well. And we had a son April 2nd, and it's just like, on one hand, it's great to have all that time around him. On the other hand, it's like my wife and I have been in the same house doing the same things for like 60 plus straight days. And it's starting to wear on us a little bit. There's only so many beers I can consume in the average day over the average month. But so speaking of LSU, you covered a national championship football team. And I'm sure there are many Texas listeners that are thinking back to 2005 in 2009, when Texas played Alabama in the college football, or back in the BCS days, the national championship game. But Texas hasn't really had one of those teams since then, and is trying to get back to that point. So first off, what's it like covering a team like that, you know, that takes you to, I mean, that deep into the season? There's that much attention on it. I mean, I saw you, it was like every week or so, it was like you had – a really detailed, in-depth piece of some aspect of the LSU football program is really great stuff. But what was it like, you know, now that you think back covering that team, what was it like during the season, you know, covering a national championship team?
Yeah, it's been a kind of a joke I've been making with people, because I've been saying, like, I don't think I'll ever cover anything like that again. Like, from just a pure content standpoint, I mean, that was probably the peak. And that isn't, I mean, I'm 25. I'll probably cover another championship in my life. I'll probably cover plenty of good teams, but I don't think there will ever be a season that I will be lucky if I ever find one that's just that full of stories and full of absurd narratives and just crazy moments. I mean, even the Texas game, like that's week two. And just like, that's one of the best games of the season. And there's all the battles over, remember the air conditioning battle, like all that stuff. Like that's like 12th on the list of absurd moments from that season. It's like a battle over air conditioning and Joe Burrow being one of the craziest stories of a quarterback anyone could remember. And Ed Ogeron probably being the greatest story of a coach any of us could ever remember. You know, just, I mean, all the personalities. So, I mean, everyone on our team had just a ridiculous kind of extreme personality, and the dancing after touchdowns and all that kind of stuff and all those guys going first round. I mean, it's just like there won't be anything quite like that ever again. So it was fun from the point of view of, hey, every week there was some area to explore or something new that popped up news-wise. It was pretty easy. And then but then you start thinking like, well, now what? But I guess on the other hand, it makes it, I guess the storylines are a little more built in this year because it's like, hey, you're replacing this. So Miles Brennan's the number one storyline because he's replacing Joe Burrow and Ken Ed Ogeron keep things going. I guess it kind of makes the storylines quite obvious this year. But yeah, no, there was nothing like last year.
Yeah, since you brought it up, I mean, you mentioned replacing Joe Burrow, but that's not, I mean, obviously that's the biggest guy that's going to have to be replaced on that team, but that team was loaded everywhere. There were a lot of fantastic players on both sides of the football that moved on. So besides the quarterback position, what would you say is that one glaring, you know, storyline that you think people like you're going to write about in terms of, you know, this guy or this position's got to be replaced if LSU's going to keep this thing going? Because I think the obvious one is the quarterback, and that's, you know, with that inexperience factor there and then Joe Brady moving on to the NFL and all that sort of stuff, I think that's kind of obvious. But beyond the quarterback spot, what's the big area for LSU that they've got to find a solution for if they're going to, you know, remain at that top tier of competitiveness in the SEC and nationally right now?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked it like that. You know, that's not very fun podcasting if I just say Joe Burrow. yeah, I think the answer is probably the offensive line, and probably even go more specific or inside baseball at center, because I think you know they're still arguably the best receiving corps in the country right now, only losing Justin Jefferson. Their defense losing a lot, but I still have a gut feeling it's going to be better than it was last year. But offensively, I mean, you're replacing 4 or 5 starters in the offensive line. Pretty much the guys coming back aren't exactly leader vocal types anyway. It's just pretty much you're replacing all your experience there. And I think we talked about this actually going into last year's game, about how the offensive line was the big question mark and all these things because 2018 was such a disaster and that was an inexperienced group. So there's a lot of similarities to that 2018 offensive line that I think a lot of LSU people are, I'm not going to say they're worried, but I just think that's definitely what jumps out because, you know, replacing center Lloyd Cushenberry, who went on to be a third-round NFL draft pick, I mean, he was for 2 years the captain of the offensive line. Pretty much, I mean, I would argue Joe Burrow was obviously the leader, but Cushenberry was the captain of the offense in a way, and I think he was the guy who coached every offensive lineman up on every call and what they had to do. He was also just a really good offensive lineman, so I think – you know, I think they feel okay about, you know, replacing left tackle and replacing right guard and left guard and all these things. But center, there's just no obvious answer. You know, it's, you know, there's this guy, Chasen Hines, who's going to be a redshirt sophomore who they like him as a talent, but he's pretty new to center. They just changed the defensive lineman to center that, again, they like his upside, but he just switched, you know. So that's the huge question mark. And maybe Harvard graduate transfer Liam Shanahan can come in and be that, but even he wasn't a center. He was a guard and tackle at Harvard. So, I mean, I don't know if that's a fair assumption that he can come right in. So it's a long way of saying, I just think they're going to be missing a lot of that leadership and connectivity on the offensive line. And the difference between 2018, I'd say, is like, and you know, this time they actually like the talent. I think it's worth mentioning that to play devil's advocate. I mean, they have a lot of like redshirt sophomores and sophomores and freshmen who they're really high on and they think could come in and, you know, maybe even be long-term upgrades, but it's the idea that I think 3 or 5 or 4 or 5 starters are going to be second or third year guys that just aren't going to be necessarily ready day one, you wouldn't imagine.
Yeah. We've seen it across all major college football even with the high recruiting rankings. You just don't quite know with guys, especially some of those big guys, until they get out there and do it. And there are examples both ways of guys that aren't highly recruited that come in and they're instant impact guys, and you know, heavily recruited guys that end up just not really quite figuring it out. Sticking with the offensive side of the ball, are they just going to try to continue what they were doing? Obviously, Joe Burrow did some very Joe Burrow things that the next guy behind him is not going to be able to do in terms of, you know, throws or reading the defense or running the offense a certain way and all those sorts of things. But generally speaking, are they going to want to try to continue running that sort of just wide open, throw it around, let's get the ball, let's snap it, let's just get this thing and go? Is that, are they sticking with that offensive identity? Do they think they can continue to pull that off now that Brady's moved on?
I definitely think so. I think that's the plan. And sure, you're probably going to see a slight, you know, reduction in, you know, if your pass run splits, just because they got to a point last year where throwing the ball downfield with Joe Burrow was actually way more efficient of a move than running the ball. And that's not exactly that common. So, yeah, I think there'll be some reversion to the mean. But overall, I think it's going to stay. I think this is the offense here to stay because, I mean, even if you just look at it from a practical roster point of view, the strength of this team is they're loaded at the receiver spots. I mean, Ja'Marr Chase is the best returning receiver, I think most of us would agree, in college football. And then Terrace Marshall caught 13 touchdowns last year as the third banana, but he's a potential first or second round pick guy. Eric Gilbert's coming in, and yeah, he's an incoming freshman, but he's the highest rated tight end in the history of 24/7 sports and the first tight end to ever win Gatorade National Player of the Year. So he's going to come in, and yeah, he's a tight end, but he's going to be split out and be a main game-changing target, they really believe. So you have those three, and then you got, you know, a five-star incoming freshman receiver, Kayshon Boutte. They really like this Racy McMath, who's coming up as a senior, and they think he's actually going to win that third spot at receiver. Point is, they really like the talent there. And then you look at Miles Brennan, who, I mean, yeah, we'll get to him, I'm sure, but I don't think Miles Brennan's going to be Joe Burrow or anything like that. But when you look at his strengths, he's a big-armed, you know, quarterback who grew up in an RPO style spread offense in high school, and that's just what he's used to. So I just think it's going to be the best suited thing for them to stick to spreading it out 4 or 5 wide, get the ball out quick. It's like, take pressure off the offensive line, if anything, by getting that ball out quick and take advantage of your strengths. Sure, they'll probably, like I said, I think they will run the ball a little more, but I just think when you're looking at your best chance, and this is what Steve Ensminger wants to do and all those things, I think they stick to what they're doing.
Yeah, I am imagining the scene in Baton Rouge if they come out first game or so and they're like, ah, we're going to go back to kind of that old style offense we were doing with, you know, that Les Miles did so often, and, you know, the power of football. It's like, no, you can't do that. And you brought up the receiver group. I mean, it's a loaded group. So I was, you know, I would bet the house that that'd be the route they want to take to try to keep that thing going as best they can. On a scale of 1 to 10, and I'm glad that we can even have these questions and conversations, because I think a couple months ago, I don't know if we'd be able to even talk about this kind of stuff given the uncertainty of football. But on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, how would you describe, I guess maybe concern's the right word about Miles Brennan, in terms of there's just not a lot of experience there. I mean, he, like you said, he's a really highly rated guy out of high school. I don't think anybody dispute the physical tools. I mean, he certainly got that, but just the lack of experience. How worried would you say the LSU fan base is? And is that the same kind of concern you get around the program, just about that caliber of inexperience coming in?
Yeah, I think the fan base is kind of at a point of they understand he will not be Joe Burrow, but they do kind of have a lot of faith in him. And maybe part of that's because of that thing of, he was actually the guy like every fan was like obsessed with 2 years ago. That they wanted him to win the job before they brought Burrow in, you know, because he was, especially for LSU, a big commit for them. They loved his upside. You know how fans are always going to fall a little more in love with upside. So he's always been kind of their like great hope kind of guy. So I think they're all in on him, and they really think he could do a lot. And from a staff point of view, I've actually been pretty surprised by how much they really are pushing that they think he's ready to come in, like be a leader, be all that. And maybe that's just PR messaging, who knows, but I've been surprised by that, because I just think the realistic expectation is, I mean, here's the thing you have to say when you're talking about Miles Brennan. It's as simple. Miles Brennan, if he came along 3 years ago at this point in his career, he probably would have broken it, you know, if he had this offense, all these things, he probably would break every LSU passing quarterback record that existed pre-Burrow. You know, I mean, because LSU's history of quarterbacks was terrible. And I think they would have been ecstatic with a quarterback who comes in and throws for, I don't know, 3,500 yards and 30 touchdowns. That would be record breaking. But because he's following Burrow, it's such it's a bizarre thing now, because he's following 60 touchdowns and 5,700 yards and all those things. So it's going to be weird, because my prediction is Brennan does have a pretty, you know, I think he's going to have a B plus season, which is pretty great for LSU, right? I think he will throw for those kind of numbers I mentioned, and and have a good year. So it is just it's a lesson in relativism, I guess, that people are going to have to adjust to. Because, listen, everyone's always known he's had the big arm, but he came in weighing, I think, like 185 as a freshman. So he was thin. He didn't really, I don't think he put the work in all that much the first year or two. And I don't think he admitted to me once he couldn't really handle pressure in the pocket because, I mean, if he got hit, he'd probably be hurt. So I think that's been a huge adjustment. And I talked to, you know, Joe Brady and before he left and Steve Ensminger, you know, this spring. And the consensus was, first off, he's up to 210 pounds. So he's gained about 30 pounds in the past year and a half. That's huge for him. And they said he's really, you know, being behind Joe Burrow has really elevated his work ethic for one, but two, just, you know, he's learned how to handle pressure in the pocket, for example. He can have a rusher in his face and make the right throw, and that's a way different thing than being in a game, of course. But I think the main thing is they feel confident that his biggest flaws he's worked on, and that's all to say I think he can be a B+ quarterback, which is enough probably to win, you know, 10 games maybe and be a top 10 team if all went perfectly.
Yeah, you can win a lot of games with that surrounding talent if you can get a steady B out of your quarterback on a consistent basis. I mean, I never thought of it like this until you just brought it up, but I was like, a fun exercise when we finish this podcast for me will be looking at how far ahead Joe Burrow is of all the quarterback statistics at LSU. Like, I never really thought of it, but, like, you know, it's never really been a quarterback program. It was like Jamarcus Russell, and you had those great stories, you know, guys like Randall and Mack and guys like that. But I was like, I never really thought of it like that. He probably destroyed all those records. I mean, he's probably far and away the second place guy on that list is probably, what, 1,000, 2,000 yards behind him? I mean, what he did last year?
I think Mettenberger held every record from 2013 when he threw for, like, a little over 3,000. And even that wasn't exactly a great season. Yeah. I mean, the context people kind of forget is that 2018 Joe Burrow, even though, like, we all talk about it now as he was bad in 2018 and made this big leap, but 2018 Burrow was still, like, a major leap forward for LSU football, and that's the context people forget.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. It has been so much of a physical defense running back type deal. I'm sure that so many of those receivers that have come through there are just kind of watching Joe Burrow shaking their head like, why couldn't I have played with that guy when I went to LSU and that offense? Because as you well know, they have never lacked receiver talent. I think that it's something that they've always been able to get on campus. Ed Orgeron, what was it like? What was it like to cover him and just be around him in a way that, you know, 99% of people don't get to see, you know, Ed Orgeron that often? It was kind of like the Ed Orgeron redemption story, you know, and it's when you think of an LSU football coach, you think of Ed Orgeron. And even prior to last season, I mean, he looks, sounds like an LSU football coach. I mean, he's somebody that the fan base, I think, was just kind of wanting to rally behind. And obviously he gave them the number one reason to, but what's it like covering him? What's it like being around him in that capacity?
Yeah, I think last year was, you know, fascinating because I think we learned a little. I think last year was kind of a lesson to include it, even though I was here before that season, is that there's just a lesson in what he does well and actually understanding it, because I think we all kind of had this notion in our head of what's Orgeron good at. And you'd say, great recruiter, great motivator, all those kind of things, like players coach. And I think he is definitely those things. But I think I learned through that season that he has certain things that he's really good at that are weird skills, right? But they're great. Because, for example, I think the number one skill I learned from people, and it's probably something that you would understand after covering, you know, three coaches in the past, you know, several years, is that top football coaches, they rarely listen, because they normally have gotten where they are by being the smartest guy in the room, right? I mean, you don't become the head coach at Texas or LSU without usually being the smartest guy in most rooms you're in. Or maybe you come there from like an Alabama, you know, tree, and you're just like, this is how we do things, and that's how you do it. And I think Orgeron, because he failed so openly and because he's part of so many trees and because it's just been an experience for him, I really learned that his biggest strength is that he will listen to people, and he understands there's not a right and wrong way to do things and needs to just figure out the best thing for each situation. So, you know, when his sports science team comes with him with the thing about, we need to cut down how we need to change the way we practice and cut down the time, but go higher speed, you know, things like that, they firmly believe, you know, Ogeron said yes, and they firmly believe that's a huge team peak at the end of the season. Or, you know, how, you know, just different things about learning, you know, for example, letting Joe Brady take over and let this 29-year-old lead this shot offense. You know, I think Ogeron's ability to just be like, what's the best solution? I'm going to get my ego out of the way. First off, he would probably tell you he couldn't do that 15 years ago. He wouldn't have. But also just that's not many coaches in America would do that. So I think that's a big thing for him. And all that is to say is that I just think we finally got to see Ed Ogeron 2019 just, you know, 20% more comfortable in his own skin. That's the part I'll remember from that season, is that I think there's always this insecurity to Ed, and it's always going to be there a little bit, especially when you come from where he comes from, first of all. But two, when you've gone through what he's gone through, I just think there's always going to be there. It's human nature. And I think we saw that a lot in 2017 and 2018 and just kind of trying to prove himself to people. So 2019, he finally got to, I don't know, be a little bit more himself and not have to defend himself all the time and actually just be like, I kind of know what I'm doing, and not have to just be like, you know, pretend to be something he's not. And I think that was kind of the cool part, I'll admit, of the season. It was just him just kind of breathing a little easier and actually just kind of showing a little bit more of what he's like. And now he's the most beloved man in Louisiana by far, Lamar Joe Burrow.
Yeah, I'm thinking now of the coronavirus message videos and the stuff he's doing. I was like, people probably get to see that 100 times and then never get tired of it because of how much the guy's just beloved now. But yeah, it's a great point, and it's true. I mean, so many of those guys, especially if they rise up the ranks quickly, it's hard for those guys to listen, you know, or to shake, you know, just their way of doing things and being a little bit closed-minded and things like that. And if you can get a big-time football coach who lives, breathes, sleeps physicality to cut back on practice time a little bit, you've got a head coach that's willing to listen to anything, because that's just something those guys seem to just grasp onto and just don't let go of forever. So kind of looking ahead to, I guess not really looking ahead that much, like right now, I mean, across the country, so many of these college football programs have announced when players are coming back, or in many cases, a lot of these players have already returned to campus in some capacity, whether it's a portion of the team or the entire team or whatever. So take us through, how is LSU handling all of that, you know, this coronavirus stuff and bringing the athletes back, and you know, what are their kind of immediate plans right now? And looking ahead, do they share the confidence of, I think, everybody in the SEC in terms of, hey, we're going to have a college football season, we're probably going to have fans. Do they share that confidence level that those things are going to happen in the fall? And then just how are they kind of taking the day by day right now?
Yeah, and absolutely. In the short term, I mean, they returned last week, and they were supposed to start activities today, but they basically pushed it back one day because of Tropical Storm Cristobal. But yeah, I mean, they tried to be kind of from what I understand from talking to people in the conference, I mean, they have kind of been one of the main leaders in the SEC and just trying to get people back, trying to write the policies, write the protocols, and actually, you know, be in charge of things so that they can actually be, you know, up front. So they were the first coaching staff, from what I understand, in college football to return to offices about a month ago. And now players are back and all that. And I think the big hurdle is just for those, you know, because they have all their things about, you know, basically wear masks around football ops if you're not in a spot that you don't need it. Or, you know, they've changed their structures for the whole building about basically trying to control traffic to make sure people are passing by each other less. They're kind of taking the side of, they're doing a lot of antibody testing, but they're only doing PCR testing right now if there's symptoms. So that's kind of a whole debate in the country right now. It's probably above my pay grade, but they are on that side of things. And then they are, to answer your second question, I mean, they are operating as if there will be a football season this year. And LSU Athletic Director Scott Woodward's kind of keeping the, I'm not saying anything confidently because so much is changing every day, but he is kind of preparing as if there will be full fans in the stadiums. He believes that we're at a point now where people are, you know, I think his quote was, people are willing to accept risk right now in the watch of sports, which that kind of got its own reaction on Twitter, and that could, you know, people can have their thoughts on that however they feel. But he's operating as if that's possible, and he's also preparing for the chance that maybe it's 30, 40, 50% in the stadiums. It seems like they're just trying to prepare for a little for each scenario to be able to move quickly when it happens. So they're not really committing too much in that sense. But to answer your question, they are pretty optimistic there will be football this fall.
I mean, he knows his fan base. You know, like if he gets on there and says, oh, you know, I don't know if we're ever going to have any fans in football and this and that or whatever, like, he knows his he's speaking to the LSU fan base that would most certainly, I'm assuming a vast majority of them would take on some risk to go watch football games. And I'm thinking in my head, like, imagine a scene where, you know, he's got to come out and say, you know what, Texas is coming up. It's the game's on September 12th, second game of the year. You know, got UT San Antonio before that. But for the Texas game, you know, the UT San Antonio game, we're only going to be able to have 40% capacity. Like, how do you think that fan base would react? Like, would we have people trying to break into the stadium or like, what kind of image in your head do you get when I tell you that? Like, imagine a world where he's got to tell LSU fans that, hey, Texas is coming to town, but we can only fill this thing to 40%.
Yeah, I mean, you know how it is these days where there's probably, you know, it's pretty split now how America is talking about these things. Because, yeah, of course, there's a percentage of people who are like, don't be stupid. You know, like they want it to be as safe as possible. They're probably, well, I know a lot of people who've already said, like, I'm not going to a game if I can. But, yeah, there is a healthy, healthy percentage of this fan base that will be livid. And I think, you know, and I say this as somebody who's a Big Ten guy at heart, grew up in Jersey also, covered sports in Mississippi for a while. Like, I've been a lot of places, and I don't know anywhere I've been that cares about that Saturday tailgate experience and just that whole drinking from 10 a.m. until the game at 7 kind of culture as LSU does. I mean, that's absurdly important there, as it is everywhere in the South and most college football areas. But I imagine there will be a bit of, you know, rioting or calling him weak and all these things if they ever do have to do that. I don't even know what it would really look like, because as you know, I mean, as the whole country knows, then the whole debate becomes, who do you let in? Are you just letting your rich donors in? Do you let students in? All these things, those are questions that everybody's trying to figure out how to answer, so I have no idea.
Yeah, that's a situation where I don't envy athletic directors, even though they're making way more money than I am. Good luck trying, if you don't have full capacity, good luck trying to figure out who gets in and who doesn't. But it sounds like, based on the way you're describing it, that LSU and Texas are kind of operating the same way from the standpoint of, I think UT Athletics Director Chris Del Conte believes that by the time the season comes around, they're going to be at full capacity, although they're kind of planning for, you know, the 25%, the 50%, the 75%, all those different scenarios. It kind of seems like both those respective athletic departments are on the same page in that regard. And who knows? I mean, I hope we do reach that point. You know, say the Texas governor just recently announced that they can operate right now college and pro teams at 50%. So if you look ahead, like, hey, we've got 3 months. Maybe this thing will actually work out after all. Speaking of LSU and Texas, how often do people bring up that 3rd and 17 still? Is that even a thing with LSU fans, or is that kind of, looking back, is that regarded as like one of the moments of the year for them?
Yeah, I mean, you'd be amazed. I think it is the moment from that season, which is funny. Yeah, I mean, I think winning the Bama game was the most important game of the season and the most important moment in LSU in a full decade. Like, make no mistake, that was the moment. But, you know, I don't think there's any moment in that game that jumps out. Or same with the championship. That was actually kind of, you know, an interesting first half, but then turned into a rout. Well, I mean, that Texas game, I think, will always carry a much greater significance than any of those other things, and especially 3rd and 17, because this, I mean, as you know, going to that game, it was still like, will LSU ever really have a modern offense? Is Joe Burrow actually any good? You know, all these things. And for it to be like that game was just it wasn't just a, hey, they finally have an offense. It was an overall, like, announcement to the world of, this offense is for real. Joe Burrow is an actual elite quarterback and all those things. So I think that's why that game, you know, has that extra novelty that those others don't, because it was like, that was the crossing of the threshold kind of game. And that moment was just kind of, remember Clyde Edwards-Helaire said after the game, like, I will talk about that throw, you know, contorted on one foot while, like, taking a hit by the Joe Burrow made. He's like, I'll take that to my grave and tell my kids about it, you know? So I just really think the context of that moment puts that above anything else. I really do.
Yeah, it's certainly talked about a little bit differently down here. I remember our message board reaction, like after that happened, just how many threads there were about like the same topic. Like, what did we just do? But I give you credit. I'm thinking back to when we did this podcast before the LSU game, which seems like it was like 5 years ago. I don't know about you, but there's certain things that happened last year. They feel like they just were, that was like a decade ago, almost the way the time is moving right now during this pandemic. But I remember talking to you and you know, you were confident about the offense. And I was like, so many other people kind of rolling my eyes. Like, I really liked Joe Burrow. He's, I'm a junior. I think he was a really underrated player considering what he did at the line of scrimmage. And he was a sneaky good athlete just in terms of, he never really got to show that athleticism, but he's a good athlete. And had plenty of arm talent, but they, like me and like everybody else were just kind of rolling our eyes like, okay, yeah, you're going to have that modern offense for the first time at LSU. Yeah. We'll believe that when we see it. No, we saw it then. So yeah, it's interesting to hear just that play still ranks kind of in that regard. And I guess like, I don't remember LSU's, you know, game by game last year by heart, but that had to be one of the closest games they had all season, wasn't it?
Oh, but I mean, it was undoubtedly the closest. It was the only real game all season that ever really had them, like, that had them truly on the ropes. I mean, let's put it this way. Until Clemson took that two-score lead in the first quarter in the championship game, Clemson, that was the first time all season LSU had ever trailed by more than one score. So, and the only time they'd ever trailed in the second half of the game, wow, just for context. So, that kind of shows. So, yeah, I would say basically the Auburn game and the Texas game are really the only ones that felt like real games all the way through. And Bama sure was like that crazy comeback and it became a close fourth quarter, but they were still technically always in control. That Texas game, though, that was by far their best one.
We'll wrap it up with some just kind of some rapid fire stuff I've got bouncing around my head still. Derek Stingley Jr., how good is he, and would he actually play any offense? Because I saw kind of that headline, and I'm thinking in my head, man, that'd be pretty fun. But I'm also thinking, well, they've got a ton of talent at receiver and running back. I mean, it's not like they like they need another guy, but just how good is he, and would he actually play any offense next year?
Yeah, so the first thing I have to say here before I, like, say what I'm about to say is just – I want to be clear, like, I'm not all positive on LSU, because, I mean, I'm not from here at all. I think the offensive line is going to have flaws this year. I think the defense will have some issues. I don't know how Bo Pelini's going to do. I think Miles Brennan's just going to be okay, all that. But when it comes to Derek Stingley, I mean, yes, I think Derek Stingley is, first off, undoubtedly, I think the best defensive back in America right now. I mean, if you really ask me, like, if I really had to really think about it, I might suggest he's probably the best football player in America. Wow. Football already. He is just, I mean, he really is that good. He is, and he's still only 18 years old, and he is just a machine. And I always call him a football robot. That's not an exaggeration, because he's almost like the Marinovich effect, but if the family was healthier, you know what I mean? Where it's just like, he has been molded for this from day one. He is huge and quick and athletic. He's a good kid. He has no ego. And he is like a machine in that he just knows exactly what to do in every situation. It isn't like he's just some like electrifying athlete who makes plays. Like, he actually once got mad at a question I asked him about, like, you know, someone compared him to Deion Sanders or something. And he's like, nah, cause I think of myself more like a technical, like analytic type. And he was 17 when he said this, and he actually cares more about the technique part. So that's a really long answer, but I just really think this part's fascinating. NFL general manager that I won't go specific, but NFL general manager told LSU in last August, so before Derek Stingley had ever played a collegiate football game, he told LSU that Derek Stingley would be a first-round pick right then, like that day. And I think that's
he was 17 then, right?
Yes, he was. That was one of the craziest things I'd ever heard when I heard that. And I had heard it from multiple people, and it's true. I mean, I think he would have been the first – I mean, it would have been the first defensive back this year taken in the draft. So he is that good. Then I'll quickly just wrap up by saying it is a thing where basically during his recruitment at Ogeron, which part of it might have just been a recruiting tactic, because a lot of kids do want to hear this. And he was like, we would even love him to play offense. And basically Derek Stingley Sr. said, we do not want him playing offense his first 2 years on LSU, because we want him to just focus on defense, back defense, make sure he builds a stock, all those things. But by junior year, if everything's going well, they would let him play some offense. And I don't think LSU needs him necessarily on offense, but I believe, yeah, I mean, I could show you some crazy videos that I've seen of him as a receiver, and I think he could absolutely be a receiver at the SEC level.
Wow. Yeah, I have no doubt he could do it. I just don't know if they would actually do it, but I can't.
Yeah, my guess is you'll never see it. Maybe a gimmick once or twice.
Yeah, but I doubt. Yeah, kind of. You know, here's your you know, special package, occasional touch type situation. Like, I cannot believe he's that young. So he could, because he's not staying in college 4 years. He could be drafted when he's 19. Is that right?
Let me think. Because yeah, it would be next. It'd be in a year from now. So yeah, he would be 19 when he most likely goes.
Yeah. My goodness, I can't. You kind of hear some of those situations and. Well, I mean, obviously with basketball and baseball with high school kids, but I can't recall many instances where a football guy would be that young and be selected that high. That is.
I don't think it occurred to me until you said it. Wow.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like to be that young and to be that good. That's good for him. I'm glad. I think Rivals.com rated him as the number one overall player. He might have been the first DB ever to get that. So, but it sounds like it was a pretty easy evaluation if you really think about it. Some guys are just undoubtedly five-star guys. The Texas program, after, you know, LSU fans or many of them went down there and then at least obviously watched the game, what do they think about Texas right now, and what do they think about the upcoming game this season? Are they – obviously, they're going to be extremely confident, and rightfully so. I mean, it's a home LSU game coming off a national championship season. But are they very confident, or are they like, hey, you know, this could be the type of thing that defines our season in terms of, you know, it could go either way. Like, what are their general thoughts on Texas right now on that upcoming game?
Yeah, I got to say, it's been kind of weird, the conversation surrounding this year's Texas game. It's that, and you said there's confidence, and that's pretty much the truth. I'm trying to think how to describe this. It's like, the way everyone describes that game is they know it'll be tough, but there's this weird assumption that it's like it's a win. And I think that is just kind of a little bit of last year carryover, maybe just a weird disrespect toward Texas. I'm not sure, but it does feel like that is just the general vibe around there, that everyone's just kind of like, yeah, that's a tough one, but that's a win, right? You know, and I don't know why, because I think Texas is going to be very good this year. I think LSU learned the hard way what Sam Ellinger can do and all those things. So, I mean, sure, LSU's home, so maybe you give them a minuscule edge if you're making a point spread or something. But, I mean, if you're doing neutral site, I feel like I would probably give Texas the edge. I'm curious where you stand on that.
Yeah, it's a great question. On one hand, it's like, you know, I feel like we keep writing, you know, like, okay, this Texas team checks a lot of boxes. And with this group, I think if you put Tom Herman in a room and say, hey, this is all off record – he would, my educated guess is he's always thought that this year would be their year in terms of the way, with Ellinger being a senior and the way they recruited in 2018 and 2019, a lot of those guys are older now and much experienced. I think they've kind of felt like this is the year they could realistically make a huge run. But I've been following Texas football for a long, long time and writing about it a long, long time. It's like, you got to see them actually do it. And until they do it, there's always going to be that sincere doubt that it's going to happen just because it's been so long. So I think on a neutral field, I would probably give the very slightest edge to Texas just because there's just more experience there and there's more experience and productivity at the quarterback position. But, man, if that stadium is full capacity coming off of months in quarantine, that is going to be quite the home field advantage. So I even with all the inexperience factor with LSU mainly quarterback, I think I would probably side with them just because we haven't really seen Texas do this. But – speaking of Ellinger, I mean, was that a guy that LSU fans and the coaching staff were kind of like, whoa, like we didn't realize he was that good kind of a thing coming out of that game last year?
I think they always knew he was that good, but I mean, it was definitely a clear, like, hey, man, that guy's the good. And the thing I'll say is, I mean, Ojan actually talked surprisingly really openly about the failures of the defense in that game. And basically what they said was the entire game plan from a pass rush point of view was to cage rush the entire game. They were like, the goal was just not to let Sam Ellinger out of the pocket. So they weren't rushing that aggressively. They were just trying to contain him. But the thing is, Ellinger was just too good at moving around that it actually made life really easy for him. So I think there's kind of a lesson in that you can't really try to get cute with him or anything like that. I think, I mean, sure, I think they did respect him last year, but I think you'd be foolish to say that they don't respect him a little more after, you know, after what they saw last year, because he made their game plan look, I mean, I'm a Dave Aranda defender, but I mean, he made Dave Aranda look kind of silly.
Yeah, speaking of that, we've gone the entire podcast and I haven't mentioned Bo Pelini. Like, I'm kind of disappointed that, like, this might end his, like, the fake Bo Pelini Twitter account. I haven't seen much coming out of there. That's one of the best Twitter accounts of all time is the fake Bo Pelini account. But, like, the defense, like, is there a concern or is it like, hey, we're just going to keep this thing churning because it was just such a team that was led by its offense, although its defense wasn't bad, obviously, but – is there any concern at all that there could be a drop off defensively? I mean, obviously that's a guy that once upon a time, he knows LSU clearly, and LSU fans know him, once upon a time was one of the defensive minds in college football. I mean, are they just kind of expecting that, hey, we've seen this guy do it before around these parts, we're just going to keep this thing going on defense?
Yeah, I mean, when I look at this defense, I actually think they should be better this year. And I think a lot of the pieces just make more sense this year, if that makes sense. I mean, last year obviously had a lot of talent, a lot of draft picks, but I don't know why. Some things just never quite clicked. They never really figured out, maybe until the postseason, they didn't really figure out the best way to use Kalavon Chase on, or, you know, I think, or for example, Patrick Lee didn't really earn the job till midseason, stuff like that. But there were a lot of flaws with that defense. Of course, I mean, the pass rush numbers jump out at you and a lot of and passing in the middle of the field, things like that. And one thing that's come out of the Pelini hire, and I think it's a good example, another insight into Ed Ogeron, is just I think we're learning that Ed Ogeron didn't really agree that much with most of what Dave Aranda did. Now, I want to be very clear, he never told Dave Aranda what to do and what not to do. And I think that's a lesson in what he's learned from his past stops, and that he knew Dave Aranda is one of the best DCs in the country, and he let him do his thing and never got in the way and was like, hey, I'm lucky to have him, go do your thing. But now that they've gone to this high, I mean, I think Ogeron wants a four-man front, kind of like he wants a four-man front that's rushing vertically upfield and letting those guys make plays like his old Miami defensive lines in the early 90s or USC in the 2000s. That's what he wants. And obviously Aranda ran a 3-4, and it was more – you know, the defense was just more – it was a smart defense, but it wasn't that aggressive of a defense and things like that. And I think Pelini's coming in. He's going 4-3. He wants those four men getting vertical. He wants two high safeties and letting those corners get aggressive. All those kind of things. He wants, you know, more aggressive blitzing, stuff like that. I think that's what Ogeron wants. So I think it's a better marriage if you just look at it that sense. And then I think it just makes a little more sense for the roster because – I think this defensive line should be the first or second best in the SEC. I think the defensive line is loaded this year with, I mean, basically with the switch to the 4-3, it means they have six starters with two defensive tackle spots and just things like that. So I think that's going to be really strong. The Jabril Cox transfer, I think, was a huge, huge win for them at linebacker because that was their biggest weakness. Now it's suddenly, I'm not going to say a strength, but at least a positive. And then you have Stingley back. You have Elias Ricks coming in as a five-star corner. And then they love Cordell Flott's work last year. So Jacoby Stevens is back. So there's not really a major weakness anymore. And it's a better marriage. So I think they should be better. I think just the huge question is, Bo Pelini, we know he was the best mind, one of the top defensive minds of football for a long time, but he hasn't coached Power 5 football in 7 years. So I just think that's really the only question of is he been at Youngstown State because he just wanted to be at home, or is there other reasons? You know, I think we'll find out very quickly, and the Texas game will be our answer. But is he still a top mind? We don't know.
Yeah, as we both know, 7 years in college football time in terms of offense, things can change quickly, and it is short of a time as just a season where these offenses are just constantly evolving. So that'll be a matchup of two teams that'll be breaking in a new four-man front defensively. And we'll see how both those things work out. But, yeah, I think like LSU, Texas understood that we got to get some more pressure on the quarterback, kind of getting back to those old roots with the four-man fronts and things like that. How would you describe the post-game scene in, like, the surrounding atmosphere after LSU won last year? Because I was like, you know what, if I could have been at any party during the last, like, you know, 12, 18 months, I was like, it'd be hard to pass up being around a bunch of LSU fans in that setting when they won the national championship.
Oh, yeah, in New Orleans on Bourbon Street.
Yes.
I mean, the thing that will always jump to my mind is, one, Joe Burrow smoking a cigar in the locker room after the game. One image. But two, Joe Burrow basically going on Pardon My Take the next morning, drunk still, and then missing the actual NCAA press conference after, like, the morning after the game because he was, you know, drunk. So, that's Joe Burrow, who is one of the most anal, like, hyper intense people I've ever met, who never lets himself do things like that. So if Joe Burrow was in that state, my answer is that must have been one of the best parties ever. And I actually, like, didn't get to go out and enjoy it. I was unfortunately, like, working until, like, the sun came up that night. So, but I heard that, like, half the team was on bourbon, and, like, I don't know too much about what bourbon was like that night, but I imagine, like you said, it was one of the best parties of all time.
Yeah, I've been there a few times, and then I just imagine that place under a normal weekend with, like, nothing going on, and then I'm like, in my head, I'm like, I don't know, like, how many people made it out of that thing alive, because that's just got to be the party of all parties. Well, kind of along those lines, if let's assume this game is going to be at least 75% capacity, or, you know, or close to 100 or whatever. There's going to be a lot of fans in attendance. So obviously some Texas fans are going to make that trip. What would you recommend or maybe a couple of things that they've got to do during that game day weekend around Baton Rouge, assuming, of course, things are going to kind of be operating as close to normal as possible, if not normal. I mean, I think, you know, things around here are already kind of getting that way. I know Louisiana was dealing with coronavirus impact a little more than Texas was. It was hitting that area harder, but it's normal or close to normal game day weekend. Texas fans are coming in. What are a couple of things that they've got to do if they make that trip?
Oh man, that's tough.
I didn't believe- I've been there. I know there's a lot. So, like, if you can narrow it down to, like, it's just things that they can squeeze into a weekend.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the first thing is, it's the boring answer, but it's just really important, is walk the tailgate scene at LSU. It's just, like, it's essential, because, like I said, I'm not from here. I've been a lot of places, and there's nothing that I've ever been around like the LSU food tailgate scene. I mean, just the jambalaya somewhere, or, you know, just all this just unbelievable food going on. I remember Andy Staples once wrote it, and he's obviously the food expert. He was like, that is the best food tailgate in the country. So you have to make sure you commit a day to that. But, you know, on top of that, I mean, I would say, you know, if you're looking for, like, a cool place to eat, Elsie's Plate and Pie on Government Street is my favorite place in Baton Rouge. It's just, like, it's basically, I mean, everything's pie, but it's, you know, savory food, and they also have great dessert pies. I'd say go there. I'd say, like, make sure you go to, you know, this place called, it's the Overpass, but it's, like, a big run of bars of the Overpass that you have to go to. I mean, go to Walk-Ons if you want. Just go to a classic LSU bar and kind of go to a place like that. Go to, you know, the River Room downtown if you want, just kind of an old school cocktail right by the big Capitol State Building, State House, and all of that. I mean, those are some of the top things that come to mind for me, but I'm going to think of some way better ones once we hang up.
Yeah, and I'll be bugging you again in a few months when this game actually comes around, and we'll have this discussion again, which hopefully by that point I will have left the house and actually gone to a restaurant again, because I really missed that. Dearly, as my son starts waking up in the background and making a lot of noise. You mentioned earlier, though, you've been making a lot of cocktails, I think. So what have you tried recently? I'm a guy that's kind of tried a bunch of different beers, and, you know, a big bourbon guy right now. So I've been kind of getting into my collection and trying some different things. So what have you tried recently that's kind of new, and what's your go-to if I'm like, hey, I'm coming over, I'm going to the bar. Whip me up whatever is your go-to drink.
Yeah, I mean, from the new point of view, I won't lie to you, I haven't tried to, like, branch out that much, because I am kind of a fundamentals guy for whatever reason.
You're speaking to a guy that loves martinis but has no idea how to make them. Like, I don't know how they do it. It's like three ingredients, but every time I do it, it's terrible. And I'm like, what am I missing? Or like an old fashioned, like, oh, my old fashioned tastes terrible. So yeah, so, like, okay. I'm not very, like, I love those things, but I just, like, I don't know, like, how is this so hard, but it should be so simple.
What I'd say is, I've done a lot of weird things with tequila, just throwing odd things together, and some of them work and some of them don't. But, I mean, if you're coming over and I'm going to make what I'm good at, I mean, I think I've perfected an old-fashioned. That is my one confidence.
Excellent.
That's my go-to drink, and that is, I mean, I got to a point where I actually stopped making them the last few weeks because I was kind of abusing it, but yeah, I mean, Old Fashioned is by far my number one. Also, just like a Paloma, like it's simple, it's an easy tequila grapefruit juice drink, but that's my go-to as well.
Oh, yeah, you're speaking my wife's language with the Paloma. Things get a little dangerous when she has those. But yeah, Old Fashioned is definitely my bourbon go-to drink. I'll give you a suggestion before we hang up here, because I've kept you long enough. There's one of my favorite restaurants down here makes something called a ranch water, which is
You already forget.
You went, right?
Yeah, that was your recommendation to me when I was
Ranch 616. Yeah, so like I've actually become pretty good at making ranch waters at home. So tequila, you can either do like a little orange juice squeeze or orange liqueur, and like I think they don't use triple sec, they use something else, but you can even use like a little splash of triple sec or a splash of mix, then with the Topo Chico. So that's kind of what I've been perfecting right now. But yeah, if you're a tequila man, I've been making those. Yeah, that's right. I'm so glad I steered you in the right direction, which that's probably going to be the first place my wife and I go when things are actually like, okay, we're ready to make the plunge. We're going to go out. We're going to rejoin society again. That's probably the first place I'm going to go. So, I'm glad I directed you there, because that makes me happy. Everybody that comes to Austin should go there. It's a very authentic Austin experience. Well, Brody, I appreciate the time, man. I've kept you for a while, but I know you and I are in the same boat, to where it's that point in June during the pandemic where there's kind of football coming back, but there's not football coming back completely. And it's like, what do we do as sports writers right now to pass the time before these hopefully workouts are going in the future and we can actually have some football to cover? But you can follow Brody on Twitter at Brody A. Miller. Again, he covers LSU for The Athletic. He joined me last year to preview the LSU-Texas game, and I'm sure he'll join me again to preview this upcoming one when the season eventually arrives, which I think we can confidently say there is going to be a football season. So for Brody, I'm Dustin McComas of OrangeBloods.com. Get to theyak.com. Check out all of our great podcast content. Until I talk to you all next time, take care.